This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Having been in news work since 1965, I will say these times are some of the more exciting which I have experienced. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Big Picture. It is an exciting time to be in the news business with President Trump. You don't have to sit around and wonder what you're going to cover. There's a nonstop stream of things right now in the 24-hour business cycles. I mean, policy decisions, appointments, press conferences, media conferences with the White House press secretary. The media has no shortage of things to talk about it. And if you look at the 24-hour news cycle, I mean, we had Navy SEALs with an operation in Yemen. The president went out to meet a family of one of the fallen sailors coming back. Dust up with the Australian prime minister over the issue of taking certain refugees. And of course, deja vu, going back to the 1960s. I remember this. Anarchism at University of California, Berkeley. It is literally deja vu from the 1960s all over again. Back then, the left, the radical left, insisted on free speech. Now they're insisting on no free speech for people that they don't like. So there is no lack of things to cover. Now, you might think this puts jitters into the market, but so far, the market seems to like what it's seeing out there. It's hard to believe, Jim, that last summer, the Dow was at 16,000, and recently it hit 20,000, up 25% since its summer lows. And more remarkable, the Fed met this week, no interest rate hike, but nobody's talking about it. You know, it's not going on and on and on and on. They've moved on very quickly. The Fed said, blah, 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 and off they've moved. So that's a switch in and of itself.
You know, it is really amazing because yesterday the Fed met. They didn't raise interest rates. There were a few changes that they had in their policy statement accompanying the meeting. But, John, you're absolutely right. I was just absolutely floored. The other thing that was hitting up yesterday, we had Homeland Secretary putting Iran on notice. And so there are a lot of things that are happening here that overshadowed the Fed. I couldn't believe on a day the Fed met, even the financial stations spend very little time talking about it. Instead, it is really a 24-hour Trump news cycle. And it's what the market seems to be talking about. And what was really amazing is we're three quarters through earnings season for the fourth quarter. And what has been surprising to me, had 242 conference calls within the S&P 500 companies. And I sat in on a couple of these conference calls, John, but over one half of the conference calls that were coming from company CEOs or CFOs, they weren't as much talking about earnings. Half of these conference calls were talking about President Trump. Everybody is positive what they're hearing about what he wants to do, lower corporate taxes. Of course, if you're a corporation, why wouldn't you be very positive on that? Lower taxes means higher earnings, and also doing away or at least reducing regulations, which harms business growth. The only negative that I heard come out from corporate CEOs is there was a little bit of worry on what could erupt as a possible trade war with our partners. And once again, what was the dominant cycle on the day that we're doing this show? It was about NAFTA. It was about trade agreements, the dust up over immigration with the Prime Minister of Australia. So it seems like everybody, or at least the news media, is captured over the Trump news cycle. And believe me, given this president, there is going to be no shortage in terms of, I mean, John, just look how the narrative has changed almost every single week. We're talking about something new, either something he said, something he's going to do, something Congress is going to do, somebody he's going to appoint, somebody who may not get appointed, who's going to be Supreme Justice. It is everything that we focus about in the news business. And I guess for those of you listening to the program, I hate to disappoint you, but what we're going to be talking about today is a story nobody's talking about, which is the Fed, because there are significant things happening here that we're going to get into this segment that we're calling the 800-pound gorilla, the risk of policy mistakes.
Well, you know, you're right about that. If you look at the shift in emphasis, although, as I've said quite frequently, the cable news channels have managed to take a 10-minute newscast and turn it into a 24-hour event. you know, whereas there's a lot more stories out there they could cover, but they always seem to focus on these just couple of hot button items. But look at it. The last couple of years, what did we discuss in the financial channels? The speculation was ongoing, even last year. Will they or will they not? Will he or will she? Will he not? Will she or will she not raise rates? That was all the discussion last year. It went back into 2015. If you go further back through 2014, there was all the tapering, quantitative easing, and the news cycle was dominated predominantly with a huge amount of speculation and chatter about what the Fed was thought to do or going to do.
And that's what really struck me yesterday. There was just so many things coming out in the news cycle. And then today it was trade. And there were some subtle hints in a speech that Yellen gave, and nobody is paying attention. And folks, this is big stuff. That's what really surprises me, because as we talked about in our first program at the beginning of the year, this was going to be a year of Yellen in the Fed in monetary policy versus Trump, the government, and fiscal policy. And, you know, so much of what happens in the economy and the market is, over the last couple of years, is always been determined about what the Fed is going to do. So here we are. Now we have something different to talk about. We have, and I got a feeling, John, it's going to be like this for the next 4 years. There is going to be no shortage. I mean, the energy level of this guy, I don't know if he even sleeps, because, you know, when you're tweeting at 3 or 4 in the morning, when are you sleeping? There was one of his economic advisors, they were interviewing one of his advisors on one of the financial shows, and they were saying he had traveled with Trump for like 3 days on this tour. And he says, I was just glad to get back home and get some sleep. I mean, this guy has the energy of, a 2-year-old or a 14-year-old. So the great thing about this, the story that we're going to be talking about is the story that not too many people are talking about, because we should be focused on what the Fed is doing and, more importantly, what they're contemplating doing, because this is going to have a major significance going forward in terms of what happens to the economy, the economic recovery, and the possibility down the road here of a recession and another bear market. Because we have begun a new rate raising cycle, and these cycles do not end until we have another recession and a bear market.
You know, there was a piece, Jim, that you published on our website called Inheritance, and you have to put all of this in perspective to see where President Trump is right now. The majority of presidents, ever since World War II, began their first year in office with a recession. So it was something they could climb out of. That meant everything is up from there. Trump is beginning just the opposite. We're not totally over with it yet. It's an aging business cycle, is the best thing I can say. And we're not in a recession, yet. Let's hold on to that one. Since World War II, there have been 13 presidents and 11 recessions. There were two presidents who did not begin their terms with recessions. That was Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton. But Bush Sr. had a recession at the end of his presidency. Other than that, we should look at the fact that every recession was preceded by Fed tightening. It acted as the trigger event for that. And so that's the case we're facing now. You have the Fed in a rate raising mode, and President Trump is inheriting $20 trillion in debt, whereas President Obama only had 10. And that debt has to be serviced. So everything that President Trump may want to do has potential limitations. Where we are in the business cycle, where the Fed is in rate raising, and confronting the servicing of that $20 trillion in debt.
Yeah, one of the things that I find is few people are talking about this. Instead, it is what we talk about in the news cycle every single day is Trump. And that is dominating the news cycle. And so far, John, the market likes this because, you know, CEOs are thinking lower taxes. That means higher bottom line. They're thinking less regulation. All of these are pro-growth things, but we'll get into a lot of this stuff may not happen till the end of the year, and it may not take effect until next year. So the markets have gotten ahead of this. And one of the things that we think that you're going to see this year, like 2016, 2017, is going to be a first half story and a second half story. And it was interesting because you talk about this article, because as Trump won and he was president-elect, he immediately started doing a number of things. And so over the Christmas holidays, I started looking at, because I pay a lot of attention to what the Fed does, because we know historically when they do this, they will keep raising interest rates until they break something. Usually the economy, the stock market, in most cases, both. And I went back and I took a look at presidential cycles. I took a look at recessions. And then I started looking. I went all the way back to World War II, looked at every president, had the inauguration dates, and then looked at recessions, when the recessions began. And then I took a look at when the Fed started their rate raising cycle. And I walked away with several conclusions. Number one, every recession was preceded by a Fed rate cycle, every one since World War II. So that was one thing that stuck out. And here we are in another rate raising cycle. And the other thing that I kept thinking about, wait a minute, we're in a rate raising cycle. The average interest rate on government debt is about 2.25%. So if interest rates overall, we'll get into the Fed's balance sheet and its implications here shortly, but for a 1% increase in overall interest rates on treasuries means the government is going to have to spend $200 billion more in interest. Last year, the government's fiscal year ending September, the government spent $430 billion in interest, even though that was $20 billion less than they paid in interest in 2008 with $8.5 trillion more debt. The reason, interest rates hit a record low. So that's been good for the government. Now we're in the opposite cycle. The Fed is starting to raise interest rates, which means it's going to cost the government more to borrow. It's going to add more interest that the government will have to pay, which is going to raise the deficit. And as when I went through this, I thought, you know, there were only two presidents that did not begin their presidency with a recession their first year, and that was Bush Sr., as you pointed out, and Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, probably the luckiest president since World War II. Both of his terms, he served without a single recession. George H. Bush, unfortunately, went through a recession his last year in office and consequently did not get reelected. But what I came through when I looked at this and I tied the presidency, I took a look at recessions, I took a look at Fed rate raising cycles when they began, when they ended, there is a direct correlation with the Fed raising interest rates in recessions. And what do we know happens in a recession? We get a bear market. The last bear market, stocks lost 45%. The bear market that preceded that, stocks lost 45%. The only mild recession that we had, and we didn't really get a bear market, was 1991, when oil prices got up to, $40 during the Gulf War. And the market pulled back, but the market was still positive. So every recession since World War II was initiated by a Fed rate hike. And here we are in another Fed rate raising cycle.
But Jim, as you and Luis Yamada discussed earlier in the program, the stock market seems to like it. And one of the things she pointed out is that in the early part of a Fed rate raising cycle, you could have rising interest and rising stock prices.
And that's what we're having right now. And this gets me back to the late Marty Zweig and his Fed indicator, you know, after three hikes, pay attention to what happens to the market. And this even goes back further to one of the legendary technicians, a guy by the name of Edson Gould, who was a technician from the 1930s to the 1970s. And he developed the three steps and a stumble rule. And the rule states that whenever the Fed raises the Fed funds target rate three consecutive times without a decline, the stock market is likely to suffer a substantial setback. So what have we had in 2 years? We've had two rate hikes. We got one in December of 2015. We got one in December of 2016. Now, given this FOMC meeting, nobody expects they'll raise in March of this year. There's probably a 25% probability. If they were going to raise, there would have been indications in the Fed minutes following, or the statement following, Wednesday's FOMC meeting. So the consensus is it is going to be sometime in the first quarter, most likely June. That will be the third consecutive rate hike. And that's the one that's going to pay attention to, because they've raised it twice. And we know they have said, at least in December, that they're going to raise it three times. In fact, the market got a little spooked in December because the dot plot said they were only going to do it twice. They said three times. A lot of people still think they'll only go twice this year. But we also know they plan on raising interest rates this year, and they also plan on raising interest rates next year. In other words, folks, they're going to keep raising until something breaks. It may not break this year, but I think there's a big question mark on 2018. And whether they break this year or they break the market this year in the economy, I think if they were to go three times and get very aggressive, I think that would happen. So they may go a little bit slower, which seems to be the indication of the language from the Fed meeting. So we know where they are going and what their track record is, and it's not very good. Since World War II, there has only been one time that I can recall in my career that we had a soft landing, and that was 1994 when Greenspan doubled the Fed funds rate from 3% to 6%, but then he stopped because we're right in the middle of a peso crisis that could have really done a lot of damage to Mexico's economy. And what are we talking about now with this president? Damage to Mexico's economy with the trade war. So we know where they're going. They are going to keep raising interest rates, folks. I guess I would be more sanguine if they said, well, you know, maybe one or two more and we think we've done enough. That's not the kind of language that you're hearing from the Fed. In fact, you are hearing more hawkish language. We don't need stimulus, and we're going to keep raising interest rates. In fact, instead of two, we're going to go three times in something we're going to talk about next. The monetary base in this country is shrinking, and for the Fed, for the first time in a decade, is talking about reducing the size of their balance sheet, which mushroomed from $800 billion to $4.5 trillion. So we know, John, given history, given their track record of breaking things, where they are going.
Okay, so then you have to ask the question, why is the market still going up? I mean, is it that they just don't recognize the things we're talking about? Or is there a belief that President Trump, what he wants to do with taxation and regulation lowering, that this will be positive, especially on corporate balance sheets, to offset whatever those other negatives happen to be?
Well, that is one of the talks. In fact, both Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal have talked about either this president, Trump, will either face the longest extended business cycle in history, or he's going to face a recession. And right now, John, the market is moving not so much on, I would say, fundamentals, because the economy slowed in the fourth quarter, and it likely will slow in the first quarter. So a lot of this is anticipatory. It's what the economy is likely to do, with fingers crossed that the Fed really means what it's saying, that they will go real slow. Because remember, when Greenspan lowered interest rates as a result of the recession of 2001, he brought the Fed funds rate from over 5% down to 1%. We're starting this rate raising cycle. We started it at 0.25%. They've raised it twice, and we're at 0.75%. We're not even where Greenspan brought it down to in 2001, when he brought interest rates down to 1% and kept them there to 2004 before he began to raise them. So we're starting from a much lower level. So, but you've already seen some of the disruption by the fact the markets run on liquidity, and we're going to talk about the risk of liquidity to the markets here in a moment. But the thing that I guess that we're not talking about is, because they said they weren't going to raise in March, there are other things the Fed is talking about that are occurring and they're getting ready to do that could be a double whammy. Now, like I said, the market right now anticipates probably the first rate hike will come in June. But they are setting the stage for further tightening in other ways that I think the markets and investors are ignoring.
Besides raising interest rate, is there anything else these guys are up to?
Yeah, this is something, and it's been a small footnote in a speech that Yellen gave, and also several Fed governors have made note of this over the last month. Since the financial crisis began, the Fed grew its balance sheet as a result of quantitative easing, or QE, to $4.5 trillion. In the last several months, the Fed is finally talking about shrinking its balance sheet. Now, the Fed holds $4.5 trillion. About $2.5 trillion of that is in U.S. Treasuries, and about 1.75 trillion of a trillion is mortgage-backed securities. Now, here's the thing that is happening that's very subtle, and they're preparing the stage. Now, in 2011, when the Fed didn't do QE, they did something, Operation Twist, where they extended the maturity of the bonds that they were buying, so they went further out in maturity. They started buying longer-dated bonds, and the idea was to bring down long-term interest rates and hopefully influence corporate buying, and especially the real estate market, and it worked. Long-term interest rates came down. The real estate market took off in 2012 and was very strong, and is still rather strong right now as a result of lack of supply. However, since 2013, the Fed's maturity on its balance sheet has shrunk and shortened from 7.5 years to 6 years. And that, once again, began with Operation Twist in 2011. And all of a sudden now, they are talking about getting rid of all of these bonds. It's only been a footnote that the Fed talks about, but every single day, as a result of owning mortgage-backed securities, and the Fed's maturity is shrinking. And here's why. If you own a mortgage-backed security, think of Ginnie Mae. Remember, people move in and out of homes. Let's say there's a mortgage pool that has 1,000 mortgages in it, but in the last year, 100 people sold their homes. When they sold their homes, those mortgages get paid off, and that principal gets returned on a mortgage-backed security. So as the portfolio gets closer to maturity, it's going to be easier to let the Fed shrink its portfolio, which is the same thing as tightening interest rates. In addition, and here's the scary part, the Fed is thinking of actively trimming its portfolio. In other words, it could shrink it by just allowing a bond to mature and not reinvest it. The bond simply disappears in thin air, just as they bought these bonds with money out of thin air. So if it trims its balance sheet, you could see, and a good example of what can happen when these things are announced by the Fed, if everybody can recall, go back to May of 2013, when the Fed was spending $80 billion a month in its quantitative easing program. It was called quantitative in perpetuity. And what happened is interest rates went from 1.6 to almost 3%. They doubled. Think of what just happened last summer when interest rates got down to 1.3 on treasuries. And by the end of the year, and especially after Trump's election, 10-year treasuries got to 2.6, the same kind of thing. Did a little digging and looked at this, is since the election, mortgage rates have gone up 0.6%. So your mortgage rates are now over 4%. Now, in 2014 and 2015, there was hardly anything maturing other than mortgage-backed securities that would pay back principal. In 2017, this is this year, the Fed has nearly $200 billion of bonds that are going to mature this year. And here's the big one. In 2018, they have over $422 billion in bonds that are going to mature. Now, the Fed has made mention that they want to keep their treasuries. They own about almost $2.5 trillion in treasuries, and they own 1.75 trillion of mortgage-backed securities. They will most likely focus, if they allow these bonds to mature, with their mortgage-backed securities, because they want to keep the treasuries. And if you look at what they're doing here, as they shrink the market, because when they have a bond mature, what they've been doing is a bond matures, they take the money and they go out in the marketplace and buy another bond to replace it. And they've been buying shorter and shorter term bonds, meaning that the Fed's duration of their bond portfolio is shrinking. And by letting these bonds mature and not renewing them, is equivalent to 2 or 3 rate hikes in addition to the increases in federal funds rate. So Fed governors, and there's several of them, that mentioned that they could start shrinking their balance sheet as soon as the Fed funds rate gets to 1%. Well, folks, it's at 0.75% right now. So meaning that the next rate hike, whenever it comes, will put the Fed funds rate at 1%. Interesting side note, that was the bottom of the Fed funds rate under Greenspan when he brought it down to 5-1. Here the Fed is talking about as soon as it gets to 1%, they could start shrinking its balance sheet. So just imagine with $200 billion worth of bonds coming due this year, if instead of taking that money as it matures, they just let it evaporate, they don't go in the marketplace and buy $200 billion worth of bonds, you could see interest rates rise as much as some bond analysts think that this could be the equivalent of just shrinking its balance sheet, the equivalent of 2-3 Fed rate hikes. So Fed governors have said 1% is kind of like their benchmark.
Yeah, but I would think we should take that with a certain level of skepticism, wouldn't you? Because if we go back over the last 2 years, the Fed has told us there were going to be a lot of raises, but it turned out they only did once or twice and nothing else happened all the other times, despite all the speculation. Now, what happens if the economy, say, for example, weakens here in the first quarter? They might have to trim off that anticipation as well of what they're going to do.
You know, I'm taking this more serious because, you know, the number of Fed rate hikes, they can always backtrack on that. Instead of 3 this year, they could go 2. But another more subtle way to tighten without, hopefully, kind of not with the markets not noticing and investors start noticing, is gradually just start not renewing the bonds as they mature. You know, unless you're following what the Fed's doing, unless you're reading their report and following this closely, you know, the market doesn't follow this. We follow more about the Fed actually raising interest rates at an FOMC meeting with the press conference, or Yellen goes up on Capitol Hill. So this is something that I am paying a lot more attention to because this is something new that they brought in. It's kind of the same thing when the Fed changes the language of its statements following an FOMC meeting. When they remove the word extended period of time, they said for a period of time, not an extended period of time. It's those little subtleties that start to add up that tells you, folks, changes are coming ahead of us. And by shrinking their balance sheet, this gets less press time and it's less notice. It's kind of a sneaky way to start raising interest rates, and hopefully nobody catches on. And their hope is that the market doesn't catch on. But it could add an additional, let's say, 0.5 to 0.75 points to long-term interest rates. We've got the 10-year treasury right now. Let's just round it off and say at 2.5%. This could take the 10-year treasury note to 3 and 3.25%, which would take mortgage rates up to closer to 5%. And when does that start kicking in?
Okay, have they done this before? I mean, how would this work?
Well, the way it works right now, when a bond comes due, let's say the Fed has a $1 billion bond come due, what they do is they just go out, take that $1 billion and go out and buy another bond. It's no different than somebody that has, if you're an individual investor or institution, you have a bond portfolio that's laddered. You've got this year bonds that are maturing. They mature. You take that money and you go out and you buy another bond, which keeps interest rates down. Under this case, what would happen is when the bond comes due, the money just disappears. They don't reinvest it. Here's the scary part. The officials don't know how markets are going to react when they shrink their holdings because they've never done it before. Since World War II, the Fed's balance sheet has increased over periods of time, especially in recessionary periods or when they were applying financial repression to the markets in the 50s and 60s following World War II to keep interest rates suppressed, much like they've done since the financial crisis ended. They've been using financial repression by buying these bonds, the same thing the ECB is doing, the Bank of Japan. They're trying to keep a lid on interest rates. You also have the issue, as these interest rates rise, another thing that has hurt corporate profits, has hurt exports, rising interest rates could raise the dollar. make the dollar stronger against other currencies, which is just the opposite of what Trump would like to see, which is one of the reasons why you've seen him lately in officials in his cabinet talking down the dollar. So the real risk here, and this is the 800-pound gorilla that nobody's talking about, are policy mistakes. The two biggest worries right now is a Fed policy mistake. The combination of raising the Fed funds rate and shrinking their balance sheet at simultaneously at the same time as they're talking about implementing after the next Fed rate hike when it gets to 1%, that's a big policy mistake the markets are concerned about, because the markets know, just like I found in my research, every single Fed rate raising cycle has ended in a recession in a bear market. The second thing that they're concerned about is a trade war. You've got that spat going on. So these are things that, John, you know, everybody's talking about Trump right now, and that's the 24-hour news cycle. What did he say? What did he tweet? Who did he appoint? What did one of his cabinet people say? I mean, yesterday on the news cycle, what was dominating the news cycle is Homeland Security coming in and talking about putting Iran on notice. That was the big thing in the press yesterday, not the FOMC meeting.
And if we return to the prediction theme, which we enunciated during the beginning of the year, during our show where we did predictions, 2017, the theme is expect the unexpected. So it seems like we're following that track.
Well, the problem is the markets are no longer, we no longer operate in free markets. You know, if you take a look at probably the last couple of decades, and it's become more pronounced under our last two presidents, much of what happens in the economy and the markets are dominated by government fiscal policy and monetary policy. If we go back to 2001, the bursting of the tech bubble, big bear market, a recession, Bush followed it with fiscal policy, tax cuts, new government spending, and the Fed under Greenspan slashed interest rates to 1% from 5%. Fast forward to the next recession under Obama. He comes in with an $800 billion fiscal spending program, and the Fed slashes interest rates from 5% down to 0.25%. So if you take a look at what we've had dominate the markets, John, you and I have been doing this program since what? The year 2000. What do we talk about so many times? What the government's going to do. Under Bush, it was tax cuts. It was fiscal spending. It was the war and the spending generated by that war. It was what Greenspan was doing, slashing interest rates, as well as when Greenspan started raising interest rates. And then Bernanke comes in, he starts raising interest rates, then he starts lowering them, then they started quantitative easing, then they started taper. So a lot of what we have talked about on the show that's dominated the markets has been government intervention in the economy and in financial markets.
Well, ever since we started doing the show together, there have been three themes that you constantly emphasize about what affects the markets. That's fundamentals, technicals, and politicals. This year, I would say politicals is steering the ship.
I can't think of any time where we are both at risk, both on the fundamental side and the political side. We've got higher interest rates. The Fed is embarked on a rate-raising cycle. That is elevating the dollar against other currencies, although Trump is talking it down. What's interesting about this is one of the things that people like about President Trump, he speaks frankly, sometimes too frankly. But one of the policies of all secretaries of Treasury, going back to Bill Clinton under Robert Rubin, is the Secretary of Treasury always talks about a strong dollar. The interesting thing is Bush's Treasury Secretary always talked about the strong dollar, but from 2002 to 2011, the dollar lost 25% of its value. Another reason why gold and hard assets did so well during that period of time. China has kept its currency weak by tying it to the dollar because the dollar was going down. However, China has recently spent more than $1 trillion of their foreign currency reserves in order to maintain the peg. So one of the ways that you can shift and change your economy and shift it from consumption to investment, which is what Trump would like to do, is devalue your currency. It's interesting because one of his trade advisors, a gentleman by the name of Peter Navarro, he was a professor here in California and was a frequent guest on my program in the last decade, and he's Trump's trade advisor. He is very much against or anti-China. And so if, however, here's the fallacy of this dollar thing. If a lower dollar is supposed to stimulate your economy, then let's talk about one of the things that Trump's concerned about is manufacturing jobs. The dollar lost 25% of its value from 2002 to 2011. Yet, during that same period of time, we lost 2.1 manufacturing jobs. I can't remember a time, John, at least as long as you and I have been doing this show together, where the markets have been so dominated as they are today by politics. The problem is our market has great expectations for stimulus and tax cut spending. And one of the commentators in the news talked about, with the emphasis on pulling out of NAFTA and trade, it seems like the president once again has shifted his emphasis from repeal of Obamacare and taxes. In fact, I'm trying to think if it was Paul Ryan that came out and said that, well, maybe on tax cuts, we may not see that to the fall, which is our contention that we put forth at the beginning of the year when the markets were going euphoric over possible tax cuts. We said, boy, by the time it gets through the sausage factory, it could be September that we actually get those tax cuts. So now looks like, as we have said here, maybe that is not going to happen until the fall. Meantime, in the fourth quarter, the economy pulled back from 3.5% growth rate in Q3 to only 1.9% in the fourth quarter. And we're following the same pattern that we have followed since 2009, where you tend to get a strong second and third quarter, but a weak fourth quarter and first quarter. And we do know another rate hike is coming before summer or as soon as June. That will be number three. We also know the Fed is going to be shrinking its portfolio. It has the opportunity to shrink $200 billion in bonds coming due this year and almost half a trillion next year. So I think once again, like 2016, the story of the markets this year in the economy is going to be a first half story and a second half story. So even though the news cycle is dominated so much by President Trump, we need to keep an eye on what the Fed is actually doing, because even though the FOMC meeting said that, well, yeah, we're on track, we're still going to raise interest rates, but they gave no indication they're going to do it in March. Watch the monetary base, because the monetary base is shrinking at the same time the stock market is going up. We're also seeing now a little bit of divergence with some of these stocks. This is the third highest market valuation in history. The most expensive was 2000. Second to that was 1929. Third is where we are today. Amazon reported earnings on the day we're doing this show on a Thursday. They missed on the top line. Amazon is selling at almost 200 times earnings. You've got Facebook selling at 50, Netflix selling at 330 times earnings, Google or Alphabet selling at 30 times earnings. On the fundamental side, we have economy that is weakening again. We have, on the fundamental side, the Fed is raising interest rates. And on the fundamental side, we've got the dollar that is rising. So, and then on top of that, we've got all kinds of political things that are starting to happen, not only here, but also overseas.
Okay, I guess the age-old question I always seem to ask is, okay, that's what it is. What do we do now?
You know, it's like anything else. They never ring the bell at a stock market top. But as you know, one of the things you may want to consider is taking some chips off the table as the market continues to head higher, is all of our technicians that we have each week are telling us. They're saying, hey, whatever you think, the trend is, they're saying more likely that the market is going to head to higher levels. So it may make some sense to start taking some chips off the table as the market heads up, because like I said, they don't ring the bell at market tops. And you will know as we get closer to the tops, especially if we start hitting new records in the Dow and the S&P, there's going to be this euphoria. It may be possible some good things that may happen down the road on the economy. And now as we talk about, when you take a look at what influences markets, fundamentals, technicals, and geopoliticals. On the fundamentals, PEs are the highest or third highest they've been in history. GDP is slowing down. On the technicals, that's on the bright side. Technicals point, the charts are saying the markets are going to head higher. Geopolitical, I can't think of more risk, including on Wednesday with the Homeland Security Secretary basically warning Iran, we're putting you on notice. We just also had our first military excursion into Yemen, where we lost a Navy SEAL. The mission was authorized under President Obama. Trump gave the go-ahead to do that. We lost the first soldier under his presidency. And you know what's interesting, John, too? We talk about politicals. One of the things that I've noticed here over the last 15 years, I mean, we spend literally six figures a year on independent research. And most of the research we subscribe to in the past, you always had an economist that was telling you where they thought the economy was going. You also had a fundamental guy, a chartered financial analyst that said, this is what we think S&P earnings are going to be. This is what we think company earnings or what sector earnings. Now, over the last, I would say, 15 years, every single one of the services we subscribe to has a political analyst, which goes to support my contention that geopoliticals or politicals are every bit as influential on the market now. You don't subscribe to services you pay a fortune for, and they're now incorporating a political analyst to tell you, like, hey, what are the chances we get tax cuts at the corporate and individual level? What are the chances we get rid of a lot of regulations that have hindered the economy? So just about every service we subscribe to has a political analyst confirming our thesis. So the dominant theme this year is going to be political, is going to have a greater influence on the markets, because if you were looking at corporate earnings, if you're looking at economic growth, neither would confirm the Fed needs to get aggressive and raise interest rates, nor would it confirm where the stock market has been going since the election of Donald Trump. So this is the year to expect the unexpected.
And the real gorilla in the room is not President Trump. It's the Federal Reserve.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Pavlova or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
William Messner joins us on the show today. He's a professor of mechanical engineering at Tufts University. And prior to that, he was at Carnegie Mellon, where he had a chance of competing in a number of the DARPA Grand Challenges. And his research interests include automatic control systems with an emphasis on applications to data storage systems, robotics, microfluidics, and biological systems and instrumentation. Fascinating background that you have, Bill. And I want to ask you about driverless cars today, because you wrote some fascinating pieces that I would like to get into. The first question I want to ask you in this space is really to think forward about 5 to 10 years from now. And how many driverless cars do you think we'll really see on the road? Because right now, we do know that Teslas can drive themselves with their autopilot mode. But of course, not everyone can afford a Tesla. I mean, most of us drive Hondas or Chevys, Toyotas, and so on. I mean, those cars, that's really the wide majority of the cars that we see on the road today. I mean, do you think that they will be driverless, or will they always require a human driver?
I think we're going to see a lot of driverless cars, but for the first part of this revolution that we're witnessing, they are going to be fleet vehicles. So they are going to be Ubers, Lyfts, maybe taxis, maybe rental cars, because you're right, they're very expensive. But for Uber, they can afford an expensive car because it's making them money. And the other thing is, a lot of them are pretty ugly. I don't want to buy an expensive, ugly car myself. But I wouldn't mind getting in one if I know it's safe and it's going to take me from one place to another. So I think we're going to see a lot of them. There's a tremendous business case for these kinds of ride services to transition to driverless vehicles.
And welcome back to The Big Picture here on the Financial Sense News Hour. You know, a fact we have thrummed a lot during this economic recovery is how irregular and unpredictable the pattern has been. We talked in the last quarter about expect the unexpected. Everyone thinks, for example, things are going just gangbusters, then all of a sudden, boom, down into negative quarters, and everything seems to slow down. There does seem to be a pattern that it follows. There's a weakening of the economy in the fourth quarter and the first quarter, and then it picks up in Q2 and Q3, whereupon it starts turning down in Q4. And we've seen with the pickup in Q3, you know, 3% growth when we were even then talking about the possibility of recession, but by Q4 it was down to 1.95. And first quarter here in 2017 could be weak as well. Now, at the same time, as we obviously pointed out in Big Picture One, the Fed's raising rates and talking about shrinking their balance sheets. Basic net effect is to decrease liquidity, to contract everything. Now, I've noticed you have returned to writing again after a four-year hiatus. So far, three articles have come out from your, I was going to say your pen, but we all write on computers now, don't we? There was an article called The Oracles on Forecast, the one we were discussing earlier, Inheritance, that the Trump presidency will be different. And now another one, Feast or Famine. So why have you jumped back into this all of a sudden?
John, I think we're at risk for another recession. It may be a 2018 story, but we do know this. We're late in the business cycle. And number two, the Fed is raising interest rates, and we know what happens every single time they get involved in a rate-raising cycle, with one exception, 1994. Since World War II, it leads to a recession, and recessions lead to bear markets. So I just looked at this, and I did a lot of reading, especially absorbing stuff from forecasts published by Wall Street firms. And then I was just curious with the new president, because he's so different from presidents that preceded him. And I started looking at recessions. I started looking at, because our recession indicator, as you just pointed out, last year, when we got to September, our recession indicator was at 20. And every time it gets to 20, we pay a lot of attention, because that tells us we're at risk of recession. The last time it got to 20 was in the summer of 2011, and we all know what happened. The market was flat that year, and we had a 20% correction in the market. So since then, that indicator has fallen to 5.5%, although it's starting to rise again. And what has happened is the economy is weakened again. So, you know, it's one reason why I wanted to return, because I think we are seeing more risk out there. And it was the same thing that I did when I wrote my Perfect Financial Storm back in 2000, is when I began that series, in my stock market series in 99. And then the day after tomorrow, and some of the things I talked about, the housing bubble beginning in 2004. So, you know, I want to get this message out there, because there are a lot of things that the media isn't focusing on. Folks, the media is always looking through the rearview mirror. They're not looking through the front window. And that's the problem with a lot of financial analysis. It's looking at what we just went through, looking behind us, and nobody's looking what is in front of us. And there are obvious things, as we talked about in BP1, the 800-pound gorilla in the room really is the Federal Reserve.
Well, where does that leave you in the market situation we are? If we're expecting the unexpected, does that make you bearish or somewhat aggressive but cautious along those lines?
I would say right now I'm cautious. On the fundamental side, we're seeing things, like I mentioned, market valuations, a slowdown in GDP. The Fed is raising interest rates. On the geopolitical side, we're seeing all kinds of risk here and abroad, and especially in Europe, which I'll get to shortly here. But on the technical side, you know, the charts tell us, like our technicians tell us every single week on the program. For example, Robin Griffiths last week, he talked about, hey, all my indicators flipped. Last time we had Griffith on the program, which was, I'm trying to think if it was October, he was a little bit more on the bearish side. Well, we had him on last week, and he was more on the bullish side. You know, and it's just like Louise Yamada. We had in the first hour, she's on the optimistic side. So the only thing of those three that looks good right now are the technicals. So I would say I'm more on the cautious side, but I'm optimistic longer term. If we were looking out, let's say, 3 to 5 years, then I would say there would be more optimism. But I am cautious, especially when we're talking about a Fed that is about to shrink its mammoth size balance sheet, and it's something it has never done before. And we saw what happened with taper. We saw what happened when they raised interest rates for the first time in December 2015. So, you know, you got to look at that and say, this is going to impact the market. And the other thing I want to point out again, the monetary base is shrinking. In other words, liquidity is being pulled from the market instead of injecting liquidity in the market, which is what we saw after Brexit. It's what we saw after QE. It's what we saw after the ECB with its quantitative easing program, the Bank of England, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, all injecting liquidity at the time the Fed was basically pulling back from its taper program. And now the monetary base is shrinking. And you can't have a rising stock market and a shrinking monetary base. Sooner or later, the monetary base will drive what happens in the market.
Well, if we had to look at all of the analysis that is going on, seems like there's an awful lot of analysis, as a matter of fact. I know here we watch the leading economic indicators. What would you say the three dominant themes are right now?
I mean, if you look at all the analysts on Wall Street, from economists to financial analysts, you know, they tend to focus on three things. They tend to focus on the business cycle, something we spend a lot of time talking about, identifying and assessing where we are within it, as we've talked about in some of my articles, aging business cycle. They also talk about reversion to the mean. If the stock market or the economy goes over in one direction, either over optimistic or over on the negative side, then all of a sudden you get this reversion back to the mean. In other words, if the stock market goes straight up, PE ratios get out of line and reverts back to the mean. Another thing is trend breakouts, which is what, for example, our technician last week on the program, Robert Griffith, talked about. Hey, his chart's flipped. But I'm a little bit more optimistic because I see a number of long-term dominant themes. Number one is demographics. Demographics are slowing. The population of the United States, Europe, Japan, China is aging, and that has implications for spending and consumption. Another thing that I see here is the rapid acceleration of the technology cycle. It used to be 10 years. It's been shortened down to 7 years. I mean, think of all the things that you've seen develop in the last 7 years, from social media to iPods to digital music to smartphones, all the things that we have available to us today that is disruptive. And there's another thing that I see coming into play here, too. It's not just the business cycle, the presidential cycle. It's the commodity cycle, which lasts 8 to 10 years, as well as the business cycle itself, which lasts 6 to 8 years. And I think, and this is my own personal opinion, we're at a pivotal point in history where we're about to see a regime change in the Trump presidency. Up until this time, let's take a look at the Obama presidency. It was dominated by central bank accommodation and quantitative easing, from the Fed's QE to the ECB QE to Japan's QE. It was dominated also by financial repression. Remember the thing that we talked about in the big picture part one? In the government's fiscal year ending 2016, they spent $20 billion less on interest expense, even though debt was $8.5 trillion larger in 2016 than it was in 2008. Financial repression was the theme. A low growth economy. It was the worst economic recovery since World War II, where economic growth averaged 2.1% instead of the 3 and 4% economic growth rates of previous decades or previous presidents. Also, it was a period of low inflation. We had inflation. It was just occurring in financial assets, but it was a period of disinflation. So if you look at where we're going right now with population growth, population growth, the number of workers and productivity determines GDP. And if you take a look at consumption, is 70% of GDP. So that's dependent on household formations, young people entering the workforce. As a population ages, people spend less. People that are retired are on fixed income. They're on budgets. They're not in their household formation years where they're getting married, they're starting families, they're buying homes, they're buying furniture, sending their kids to college. as a population ages, more people are going to be drawing from the economy than are coming into it. So there's a potential structural growth in the world that has been lower historically. Also, demand for most services, with the exception healthcare, will continue to grow because we are becoming more a service economy. There's also potential economic growth will stay lower for longer in Japan and Europe as a result of their demographics. The other thing is the demand for income from investments is going to continue to grow. Dividend stocks, high yield bonds are going to be a theme that's going to be with us as a long time as 75 million baby boomers in the U.S. head into retirement over the next 10 years. And it's not just happening here. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in Japan. It's happening in China as well. So demographics are going to be a major factor that's going to change. Another disruptive force is going to be technology. I mean, just take a look at what we've seen happen. I saw a graph of the number of manufacturing jobs that have taken place. We are making more stuff today with fewer workers. I saw another graph in a report that I read that showed the number of McDonald's restaurants that are opening up globally is increasing, but the amount of employees that work for McDonald's is decreasing. In other words, the labor force per restaurant is starting to shrink as more and more things are disrupted and automated. Think of the disruption of Amazon. Amazon is getting in the grocery business. They're getting in the home delivery basis. I get Amazon now 7 days a week. I only used to get it with UPS and used to get it with FedEx. Now, Amazon is employing the equivalent of Uber drivers to deliver. So you get Amazon delivery on Sundays. Amazon is going to go into self administered grocery stores. They've opened up two or three. They are going to start opening up the equivalent of many airports and hub centers for their drones and also for delivery. So there are more disruptive forces that are going to change the shape of the economy. And we're going to be doing a special on this on Megatrends coming up here, a very, very significant show. One of the probably most significant shows we'll do of the year coming up with a special guest we're going to interview. The next 10 years, most routine jobs are going to be automated. And that has significant job implications, folks, because what has dominated U.S. job growth in this economic recovery, and I was really surprised when I was doing research on this, is 100% of employment in this economic recovery has occurred in the service sector. If you take a look at the manufacturing sector today, has the equivalent of almost 1 million fewer jobs than when it reached its peak going back to the peak of the cycle in 2007. So basically, we're making more stuff with fewer workers as more and more of the manufacturing process is automated. Now what you're going to see is that you're going to see the service sector begin automation. You're seeing it in restaurants with kiosks now. You're seeing it with millennials. A lot of them have smartphones. They go to their fast food restaurant. They order it through their smartphone, and you just have somebody at the cashier that takes their money, and pretty soon that may be automated too with Apple Pay. You may pay automatically and just sit there and pick it up. They'll have to have somebody that's going to give it to you, but a lot of the cooking will be done and automated as well. So we are starting to see this aging demographic, which has implications for economic growth rates, which is basically workforce times productivity gives you GDP growth.
You know, if we look at an aging demographic and then the participation rate declining, what can we genuinely say the opportunities for job growth in the future are going to be and what might be driving it?
Well, there's two sources of additional job growth. There are a lot of individuals that went back to school. There wasn't much of a job opening following the Great Recession. And so a lot of people just went back to school, got other degrees. So you have people coming out of school. That's a potential source. You also have aging boomers who may not be able to retire or may have a second career or part-time job in retirement in order to maintain their lifestyle. So students and retirees or potential retirees are a source of employment. But I also think the CapEx picture is about to improve, both on the manufacturing side with some of the things that are going to be done here with taxes and also with regulation. But also, I think you're going to see it with the credit cycle. As the yield curve increases, it makes it more profitable for a bank. Think, folks, if what you're seeing at your bank right now, what are they paying you, even though the Fed has raised interest rates, and interest rates have almost doubled since last summer? What are you getting on your bank CDs? Probably not much. But what are you being charged if you go out and get a new car loan, or let's say buy a new home on a mortgage? So the credit cycle could improve. One of the problems with quantitative easing and with negative interest rates, it hurt the banking sector, which also hurt the creation of credit. One of the things that characterize this business cycle is credit creation has been on the low side. So you've got two possible things that could help the banking sector: the removal of regulations, part of the restrictions with Dodd-Frank, and also a steepening yield curve.
Yeah, but corporations, Jim, have been able to increase their profitability by, you know, stock buybacks, refinancing the debt, dividends, all sorts of little mechanisms to deal with the current situation.
Well, if you take a look at, there's only three ways that a business is going to increase its bottom line. One is top line revenue growth. It's one of the reasons why you're seeing high PE multiples on companies like Amazon, Netflix, Google, and Facebook, because they have top line revenue growth. I think Facebook's revenues grew by 50% when they reported earnings. The second way you improve profits is margin improvement, where you improve your profit margin. If you had a profit margin of 10%, you improve it to 15%. That's more money to the bottom line. And the third is leverage. Well, if we look at this economic cycle, leverage, they've already used leverage. They use that to finance debt. They went in the marketplace, I can remember the year 2013. Intel issued a $5 billion bond at 1.6% and retired their stock that was paying a dividend of 4%. So corporations have already leveraged up. Now interest rates are going up, which is going to make it more expensive to borrow money. So that trend is coming to an end. Secondly, in tax reform, with corporate tax reform, one of the things that Trump is talking about doing, and the Republicans, is elimination the deductibility of interest expense. So they don't want to get companies highly leveraged, which has caused a problem in a financial crisis. They want companies to start issuing equity and finance it with equity rather than debt to avoid future financial crises. So leverage is out of play. They've already gone through margin improvements with the refinancing of debt at lower interest rates, with the shedding of jobs during the Great Recession. So there's only one way you're going to get profits to increase going forward, and that is to get top line growth. Companies are going to have to get back to reinvesting, increasing productivity, modernizing plants, and all of that is made possible if a couple things happen. And when you listen to Q4 earnings calls with CEOs, you know, Trump came up half the time of the earnings call because they were talking about lower corporate tax rates, a one-time tax rate to repatriate profits. They also talked about regulation, lower regulations and the impact on the bottom line. If you listen to banks reporting profits, which were up, they were one of the big contributors helping to the bottom line. Energy companies lost less money. Banks were making more profit. And a lot of that was the financial people talked about that there was a steeper yield curve, and it makes it more profitable to lend. Folks, when you can get a higher profit margin, you're going to do more of that. If banks can make more profit by loaning you money on a mortgage or loaning money on a home equity loan or loaning money to buy a car, they're going to do it when the profit margins widen. So a steeper yield curve could help credit. So all of these, John, are all positive in the long run. But in the meantime, we've got major political risk or policy mistakes, as we covered in BP1, with the Fed, and also a trade war. But we also have geopolitical risk. On Wednesday, Homeland Security putting Iran on notice. And just as the Brexit vote and the Trump presidency was disruptive to the markets, we've got a timetable that's going to occur in Europe. January 22nd, France Socialist primaries, that's already passed. We've got Italy's Constitutional Court hearing March 15th, the Netherlands general election, and we've got a far-right candidate there. March 31st, the UK deadline to institute Article 50 to begin withdrawing from the EU. April 23rd, France's presidential elections. May 7th, France presidential elections round two. And September, Germany's general election. So, John, no shortage of political policy mistakes and political risk, no shortage of geopolitical risk, no shortage of trade risk, and no shortage of Fed risk. So these are the things I think are going to occupy the markets this year. But there are a number of things that, if enacted over time, would have a positive long-term effect on economic growth and corporate earnings. But I think you're talking about maybe a 2018, a 2019 story, which, if I was Trump, I would want that to be occurring in 2018 and 2019, assuming he wants to run and get reelected and not find himself in the same position that George H. Bush found himself in, a recession in his last year of office. So we've got a tale here of two economies. It's been a service economy. What has been lagging is the manufacturing economy. And there are a number of things that are taking place here that may change and showing signs that manufacturing is starting to pick up. Because one of the reasons I believe we've had this unequal economic growth, this stop and start growth, is between 2014 and 2016, the manufacturing sector was going through a recession. We certainly saw that in the PMIs, the ISM dipping below 50. And I think manufacturing is starting to bounce back, and more likely to bounce back now with the presidency of Donald Trump.
And as we round out our show here, I said at the beginning of the show, there is no lack of excitement and news to cover, which for news people makes it interesting. What do you foresee coming up in the near future? Donald Trump will quiet down and become a normal president, right?
I think highly unlikely. I think this is going to be a news-driven presidency and a news-driven year. I think, once again, politicals are going to be driving the market this year. And, John, we are not going to have any shortage of things to talk about in the weeks ahead. We are going to be doing a special couple shows coming up in the weeks ahead. But, you know, it's amazing where we spent year after year just talking about the Fed. Now we're talking about a president and what's occurring there. We're also talking about events that are occurring on the political side overseas. And John, you've been in the news business. I can remember, you know, I did television news for about a year and a half. And you remember what it was like when you were in the studio on a slow news day? I can remember it was a Friday and there was just absolutely, it was summer. It was nothing being covered. We didn't have any shootings. The old saying in the television business, if it bleeds, it leads. We had nothing. So our lead story with the day, dog bites jogger. I mean, that was our big story. In Oceanside, a jogger jogging along the beach was bit by a dog. Well, we're not going to have any slow news days, at least in 2017. Not with this president and everything else that's happening. Well, in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.